What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
And we welcome you in the Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside, the League of Legals. My name is Sam Paniadovich. The W's are flying. And Rich, you were at Game 7 last night in Cleveland. We'll get to that a little bit later on in the show. But we'll open things up with Alderman Leslie Hairston from the 5th Ward on Chicago's South Side. And there's a situation going on. Cranes wrote a piece about Chicago's top law firms lacking diversity, and clients are starting to notice. So we welcome the Alderman in on WGN Plus. Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon, actually.
Thanks for joining us. Your ward covers parts of Hyde Park, Woodlawn, and South Shore. Alderman, tell us about the issue you raised recently during a city council committee meeting involving racial diversity or lack thereof, and specifically involving the law firm of Chapman and Cutler.
Well, you know, let me just say the communities that I represent, which are Hyde Park, South Shore, Greater Grand Crossing, and Woodlawn are extremely diverse. And as a lifelong resident of these neighborhoods, you know, diversity has been all around me. And it wasn't until I got out there in the real world that I realized that everybody was not as tolerant, as accepting as we are here in my neck of the woods. One of the things that I have been a longtime advocate for is the diversity in the legal profession, both in my profession as an attorney, but also as a member of the Chicago City Council. We look at billions of dollars that filter through the city of Chicago that go to different types of businesses and firms and accountants, and some that are here in the city of Chicago, some that are in other states. And it is mind-boggling to me the number of, and for me, it's African-Americans that are not represented or either underrepresented.
So let's talk about why that is. You're a former assistant attorney general for the state of Illinois. You're also a former staff attorney and special prosecutor for the state's attorney's appellate prosecutor's office. So you've been around the law now for many years, both as an alderman and as an attorney. We often hear how important diversity is to large corporations. I represent many of them, so know that to be the case. Yet, why is there a disconnect between, you know, corporations and their general counsels talking about how important it is to have a diverse panel of outside counsel, yet the statistics show that that's really not happening very frequently? According to American Lawyer, 88% of 235 attorneys at Chapman and Cutler and 91% of partners were white. And I don't mean to pick on this one particular law firm, but they were the subject of this discussion in the city council. So, again, my question was, why do you think there's a gap between large corporations wanting diversity and that not happening at a lot of law firms?
Well, when you want diversity, you can get diversity. If you don't want diversity, you will not achieve diversity. You know, they make it seem like we're trying to find a needle in a haystack. You know, and when I was coming up, it was the same for women, you know, as well as women of color. So, you know, there were a lot of different issues going on. But to see this some 25, 30 years later, you know, how long does it take? So I don't think that there's a real effort.
Alderman, are there law firms that you work with or that you've worked for that achieve this diversity? And if so, how did they achieve it?
Well, I've been an alderman for almost the past 20 years, so I have not been practicing law. But one thing that I can tell you is that when I was with the state's attorney's appellate prosecutor's office, that I was at one point, I think I might have been the only person of color, I went to my boss and I said, you know, this doesn't make any sense. This is a great, you know, opportunity. I think students in law school should be exposed. And then I set about creating a summer minority internship program, which still continues to this day.
You know, Alderman, I don't know the statistics on it, but as far as the law school makeups, I mean, are the law school classes pretty diverse? I mean, I graduated some time ago, so I'm trying to recall myself, but are they? Is there a diverse candidate pool to draw from for these large law firms?
Yes, there is a diverse candidate pool to draw from.
Yeah, and I'll second that. I mean, we do. You know, I'm a member of the Board of Visitors for Northern Illinois University, and we've done a lot of we've had a lot of them guests from that school on this show. You know, they're right out there among the most diverse law schools, not just in this area but in the country. And you know, they're doing great work in the public law sector. So yeah, I mean, I agree that there's plenty of candidates out there. It's just a question of, and I think what you're trying to do is, you know, get them to have opportunities at some of these law firms, correct?
No, absolutely. You know, there was one young lady, and I don't know who she is, but she came up to me afterwards and said, thank you. She said, I'm a young lawyer. You know, I'm looking. So, you know, the same type of opportunities that are available for other students are not being made available to students of color. And that is very concerning in a city as diverse as Chicago.
So well, as a practicing attorney too, I mean, Alderman, how do we encourage that, and how do we help push the you know, diversity in these in the legal community?
Well, I think we have to put our money as where our mouth is. So that means if you don't have the diversity, then you don't get the city contract. We don't invest with you. You know, it has to be more than lip service.
That's Alderman Leslie A. Hairston from the 5th Ward in Chicago here, and the website is leslieahairston.com. We appreciate your time. Keep up the good fight.
Thank you very much.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
As we move along to our second guest of the show, Jessica Jackson Sloan, who's the National Director and co-founder of Cut 50. The website is cut50.org, and she joins us now on Legal Face-Off. Hello, Jessica. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Jessica, thanks for being a guest on Legal Face-Off. We appreciate it. We're going to talk to you about Cut 50, and you know, it's been very much in the news recently about President Obama nearing 1,000 commutations at this point. So before we talk about that, tell us how you became involved with this cause.
Absolutely. So mine is a little bit of an untraditional path to law school. I was 22 and living in Georgia, pregnant with my first daughter, when my husband unfortunately became addicted to methamphetamines. He was working a lot late at night in the construction industry, and it was 2004 during the middle of the meth boom in Georgia. So he started using them and became addicted and unfortunately was arrested. Of course, I naively thought, well, he's been arrested now. He's going to get help. I turned out to be completely wrong. So we ended up being put in a situation of taking a plea deal that was 15 years, served 6, and he served 3.5 years of those 6 years, and then the remainder on parole. But I had a 2-month-old child when he went into prison, and unfortunately, I saw firsthand how the prison system just really rips families apart and didn't even help him. You know, he went to prison, and unfortunately, he never got rehabilitation. Nobody ever asked him, you know, why he had done drugs or what they could help him do in the future to stay off of them. Instead, he was sent out to work for 52 cents an hour, still in the electrical field, but, you know, not actually making an income for the state of Georgia.
So that led you to look at this issue and eventually co-found Cut 50. What is Cut 50, and what are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah, well, my own experience taught me that, you know, there's a system that's just broken. And I decided to go to college and then law school. And I came out and represented death row inmates in their appeals here in California in both state and federal habeas appeals. And I met Van Jones, who at the time was starting a new TV show, Crossfire, with Newt Gingrich. And Van and I were talking about the criminal justice system. I told him about my experience and, you know, that I wanted to really move into the policy side of the issue and start bringing reforms that would affect families like mine. So he mentioned this in conversation, as you might imagine, with Newt Gingrich. He normally didn't agree on anything with him. I mean, the entire show's premise was that they disagreed on everything. And when he mentioned criminal justice work, former speaker started to shake his head and nod along. And he said, yeah, there's too many people who are incarcerated, and we need to do something about this. So Van and I co-founded Cut 50, which is a bipartisan national organization meant to end mass incarceration by cutting the prison population in half in the next 10 years.
Right, and Jessica, how do you guys intend to do that? And what crimes are you specifically focusing on?
Right. So there's three basic areas. There's the pretrial, there's sentencing reform, and then there's reentry. And in pretrial, currently there's 450,000 people across the country being held behind bars without a conviction. So we're looking at bail reform. We're looking at pretrial detention, ways to get people home who are not a threat to the community, but who right now are simply being held because they can't afford to pay their bail, so they can't afford to get back to their lives. And this has just devastating effects on their lives. They can lose their job. They can lose their housing, sometimes custody of their children, just huge impacts, not to mention the stigma and trauma from being arrested and staying in jail. We're also looking at sentencing reform. So we supported the Safe Justice Act last year in the House, and then the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. Currently, we are supporting Proposition 57 here in California. That would have an impact. We've also done some work in the past on Proposition 47, and you'll be seeing next year we'll be moving quite aggressively into the states around pretrial as well as alternative sentencing for nonviolent crimes, but also path to reentry for those who have committed other crimes. And then in reentry, you know, 90% of the people, the 2.2 million people who are behind bars, are going to come home at some point. And our choice is, do we want to bring them home in a way that sets them up for success, or do we want to continue what we're doing, which results in 74% of them returning to prison? So we're working on a huge reentry initiative that's going to be launched next year and is going to be a nationwide initiative.
Jessica, you talked in your article in HuffPost that, you know, I found very striking. This is an article from June of 2017, originally April, and then updated in June of 2017. It was called Seizing the Moment to Reform a Criminal Justice System. In that article, you talk about the impact that your ex-husband's incarceration had on you and your, at the time, your two-month-old daughter. You talk very specifically about things like not knowing if he was going to get your correspondence, not being able to afford phone calls, which were $17, not being able to afford the cost of gas. So what you just described earlier was, you know, some large, big picture items. Talk a little bit about these specific items and, you know, the impact that these things have on families like yours and what Cut 50 will do to remedy some of these issues or what you hope to do.
Yeah, so I think our reentry initiative in particular is geared towards really setting people up with jobs and changing the culture of corporations across the country so that folks who do come home have the support they need to maintain a job and an environment where they can be successful. But you're right, it has a huge, huge impact and a devastating human impact. And it's really easy to look at the statistics, the 2.2 million people who are behind bars, or focus on the crimes. But what you don't see in those statistics is the faces and the stories like mine. You know, I was only 22 years old and I had a 2-month-old baby. You know, we couldn't afford to pay the mortgage. I just had a kid. I had my GED at the time. I was very, very lucky because I came from an academic family. I'd grown up out in Marin, California, where pretty much everybody went to college. So when I came home and said, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to become a public defender, my parents might have laughed a little bit because obviously I didn't know what all that was going to entail. But they were supportive. And, you know, I had to take out massive, massive student loans to make it. But I was able to. And not everybody is in a position where that's an option. So we hope to be able to bring people home, people like my husband, who could have gone to a rehabilitation facility and gotten the help he needed to get off drugs and not ever possess drugs again, versus costing the state money to sit in a cage and not get help to get him off drugs.
Jessica, what about Obama has been, you know, very very much in favor of commutations for these kind of offenses. Have you worked with his administration? How do you feel about the record pace that the president is on before he leaves office to commute some nonviolent offenders, sentences?
Yes. So 2 years ago, the DOJ set forth criteria for who would be eligible for clemency. This is nonviolent offenders, as you said, first-time drug offenses, people who have never had a violent offense, not even in prison, which is pretty hard to do. These are people who were not playing any sort of significant role in any criminal enterprise, and they've been in there for at least 10 years. So it's very narrow criteria. There's probably 1,500 to 2,000 people of the 200,000 in federal prison that meets this criteria. But with that announcement brought a lot of hope for people. We've seen a record number of clemency applications. And as a result, we've also seen a record number of commutations being issued. Currently, it's over 750. And we're really hoping that everybody who meets that criteria is able to get clemency by January 20th. Yes.
That's Jessica Jackson-Sloan. She's the National Director and Co-Founder of Cut 50. The website is cut50.org. And to read more about the story, she wrote a piece for the Huffington Post, seizing the moment to reform a criminal justice system that hurts families and communities. Thank you so much for your time on WGN.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
And we welcome you back to Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus with Rich and Jason. My name is Sam, and we're going to talk now about the STEP test and some other discriminatory tests used by the fire department. We have Josh Karsh, who's a shareholder at Hughes, Sokol & Pierce, and Marnie Willenson, who's an owner at Willenson Law. They join us now on WGN. Hello.
Hi.
Hello, good afternoon.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Marnie, tell us about the lawsuit that you filed just last week against the city of Chicago on behalf of 12 women. Specifically 12 paramedics who passed the city of Chicago's pre-hire test, enter the fire department's training academy. What happened next?
Well, you are correct. They all passed all of the pre-screening requirements for the fire department, which included the paramedic physical abilities test, which is the city's chosen test to screen for physical skills, physical endurance before you enter the fire department. Once our clients entered the fire department, they were informed that there would be additional physical tests in the academy. And they discovered that the city had invented additional physical tests, which included what you referred to as the STEP test, which we believe is more accurately referred to as a box test.
I mean, it sounds like a joke. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like kind of a joke. Because tell us, yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe unless you read the complaint. It's patently absurd. I mean, from the face of your complaint, tell us what this step test is and involving a metronome. Just tell us about that because it sounds crazy.
Right. So they would take an 18-inch box and require the paramedics in the academy to hold a 25-pound weight in each hand, so a total of 50 pounds of weight, and step up onto and down off of the box to the beat of a metronome set at 112 beats per minute, and to do that for 2 minutes without losing the beat.
And Josh, I mean, on its face, this test sounds like it sounds ridiculous, but it doesn't sound discriminatory. How was this discriminatory towards women as opposed to men?
Well, we're not hiring people to be ballroom dancers, you know, so it's pretty ridiculous on its face. It's got nothing to do with the chop. The reason it's discriminatory for men is for reasons good, bad, or indifferent. 100% of the men do it and pass. 20% of the women don't. And the law is if you give a test and it has a discriminatory impact, it favors one group or another, and it bears absolutely no relationship to what you do on the job, then you can't disproportionately exclude the people who aren't passing. In today's day and age, it is preposterous to think that qualified men and women aren't both available and equally available to be paramedics.
Let's break that down a little, Josh, for our listeners, because that's actually, you know, a little bit of an involved legal theory. It might be clear, but let's just break that down because I don't think it's I think it's worth explaining a little bit. So you're not alleging that this test was administered only to women, correct?
No.
The test is administered to both women and men.
Men and women, absolutely.
But the fact is that 100% of men pass it and only 20% of women pass it, correct?
No. 20% of women don't pass it.
20% of women don't pass it. All right. So 80% of women pass it. So why does that 20% difference mean that this test is discriminatory? Explain that for us.
Okay. It's discriminatory because it's excluding 20% of the qualified women who apply for this job for no good reason, because the test itself doesn't measure anything that has anything to do with the job.
So if the test was, you know, let's say carrying a hose up a ladder, which is obviously directly impactful on your job as a firefighter, or if it was a paramedic test involving carrying, you know, let's say a stretcher, then you would feel differently, even if the success rate was different. Is that true?
We might, right. Nobody is advocating that unqualified people should be hired. But what we are advocating is that if you want to give a test and screen out people, it's got to distinguish between people who can do the job and people who can't. And if what you're asking people to do is step on and off a box in cadence with a metronome, as if it were ballroom dancing, for 2 minutes with the metronome going 120 beats a minute and you can't break the beat, you've got nothing. It bears absolutely no relationship to any job in the fire department. You're given a test that's designed to fail people, but isn't designed to pick better firefighters or paramedics.
Marnie, this is not certainly the first suit against the city of Chicago Fire Department. In fact, not the first successful suit. Tell us about the other prior victories that you and others have had in suits against the city of Chicago in an effort to end discrimination in fire department hiring.
Well, so the most recent victory, I think we can go in reverse chronological order, but in September, we were successful in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in another case involving paramedic hiring. So in that case, the city had instituted a previous version of a pre-hire physical abilities test. And the Seventh Circuit found that that test was discriminatory against women. So that opinion was issued in September. So this case that we filed on Friday comes on the heels of that opinion in September. What was different in our case is the current case is that the city replaced, as a result of that litigation, while it was pending, the city dumped the test that the Seventh Circuit had just said is discriminatory. They got rid of that test and they developed a new one. The new test was this paramedic physical abilities test that our current group of plaintiffs passed in order to get into the academy. So the city effectively replaced the pre-hire test. Our current paramedics passed the pre-hire test and then were flunked in the academy on new tests. So the most recent victory we had was in our Ernst versus City of Chicago case, where the Seventh Circuit held that the previous pre-hire test was discriminatory. Prior to that, we had filed and settled successfully, resulting in hiring orders from the federal court here in Chicago over the pre-hire test used to hire firefighters. So it was a similar process where you put your name on the list, the city creates a lottery, and then processes people off this list. And one of the first next steps in the process is taking a physical performance test. And in our two earlier class action cases, we challenged the physical performance test on the same theory that Josh articulated, that it disproportionately eliminated women and was not related to the job of being a firefighter. The test in that case was similar to our current box test in the sense that it didn't look like firefighting, didn't appear to have anything to do with firefighting. It involved three events. One of them was cranking on an arm crank bicycle machine. They call it an arm ergometer. So we had similar issues in that case and were successful in those cases in settling the case with the city. And we had a total of 45 women enter the fire academy as a result of those settlements.
All right. And then you also pointed out, too, that this the discrimination that you allege against the fire department has a trickle-down effect with the wages. Can you go into a little bit of detail on that? There was talk about how the city hiring practices and, you know, disparaging against the women force them to go work out in private ambulances, and they make less money than the counterparts of the fire department.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it cements a huge wage differential in the job market. So the people that are applying to be paramedics for the city of Chicago, you already have to be a licensed, and in most cases, you're also an experienced paramedic. They're coming from the private ambulance companies that you see all over the city. With the lights on and everything, they're just not working for the city of Chicago. They're working for private ambulance companies, and the wages working for those private ambulance companies can be like $15 an hour versus a job that you start in the city of Chicago at about $55,000 a year plus the full panoply of benefits. So there's a huge wage differential between the job of a city of Chicago paramedic in the job of a paramedic at a private ambulance company. And by eliminating a significant number of women from the jobs for the Chicago Fire Department, you're cementing a wage gap.
Marnie Willenson is the owner at Willenson Law, willensonlaw.com, and Josh Karsh is a shareholder at Hughes, Sokol & Pierce, hsplegal.com. Thank you both for your time, and we'll talk to you down the road. And we wrap out the interview portion of our show. Four different segments with interviews today with an associate attorney at Brennan Bertker. You might know the last name. It's Blair Kipnis, the brother of Jason Kipnis, who's a second baseman, an all-star second baseman for the Cleveland Indians. And Blair joins us now. A long night, I assume, on your way back from Cleveland. Welcome.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, Blair, you were at the deciding game yesterday, Game 7. Your brother has had a great run. Fortunately for us here as Cubs fans, unfortunately for you, run ended last night. But, you know, you're a practicing attorney here in Chicago. Your brother is a major leaguer. How has the last 3 or 4 weeks impacted your ability to practice law? I know, having gone to many games myself, it's been tough to concentrate. A lot of my office, you know, our billing is way down. How has it affected your practice?
Really, in two ways, and you named the first. It's the ability to focus, it's the billing, it's when you're there trying to get work done, you're distracted thinking about the games. I was very fortunate to be able to go to all 7 games because Jason was able to get tickets for my parents and my siblings and I. So you lose a lot of time traveling, you lose a lot of sleep trying to drive back from Cleveland in the middle of the night or early morning to get back to your desk. It's exhausting. But fortunately, I had a law firm that was extremely supportive of it. They're all Cubs fans, and you know, I've certainly taken my ribbing today getting back into the office already, but it's really been a wonderful experience, notwithstanding the exhaustion.
So you've got several siblings. You played sports growing up, and I'm interested in knowing how, you know, your path chose the legal route and your brother's path chose the professional sports route. I assume a lot of that was decided for you because, you know, your brother could probably hit the curve and, you know, maybe you couldn't. So it wasn't exactly a choice if you're like, you know, me and a lot of my athlete friends.
Sure.
But tell us a little bit about growing up on the north side of Chicago and how important sports and then ultimately law was in your life.
Both very much so. My father was an attorney growing up. He's been the biggest role model in my life, hands down. And it wasn't as much as trying to follow in his footsteps as much as it was just something that really interested me growing up as well. I have three other siblings. I have an older sister, Amanda, and a younger brother, Todd, and then Jason's the youngest of the four of us. We all grew up athletes. We all grew up playing every sport you can think of. And then as we got closer to high school and had to start focusing in on them, we chose one per season. Amanda ended up going on to play Division I softball at Maryland after playing Little League Baseball in Northbrook as the only girl in all Little League Baseball and competing very well there, too. But it was always nice. We always had someone, anytime anyone wanted to go play catch or go in the backyard with a bag of wiffle balls and just hit a bag full of balls just to get some swings in, there was always a sibling ready to jump outside with you. So it was pretty cool growing up.
How competitive was that household with the kids?
Not as much competitive amongst ourselves as much as just when we got on the fields, we were always just fierce competitors. And, you know, we always wanted to win. We always wanted to push each other to get better.
So you've been involved, Blair, in a lot of large cases representing hospitals, nursing homes, medical groups, lots of medical negligence cases. When you sit around the table at Thanksgiving and the whole family's there, who has the better war stories? Is it you defending, you know, medical negligence cases, or is it your brother, you know, facing off against some of the best pitchers in baseball? And how do your parents sort of, you know, prioritize those stories?
Yeah, my parents have been wonderful about all of it. They're as proud as can be of all four of their kids. And as much success as Jason has had on the field, we're proud of him for the way he works hard and the way he carries himself on the field. The results are great, too, and it's fun, and that's the stuff that gets talked about. But when you talk about family pride, the pride is in the work ethic. The pride is in the way, you know, our family sort of carries ourselves and the way we go about our business. And so in that sense, you know, it's even keel for all of us.
Well, I'll tell you, brother seems like a good guy. I watched a couple of his YouTube videos, especially the one following Game 6. Yesterday, he had a pretty good head first slide following one of the pass balls. I know he's known for his slides. And he's a real fan favorite. I was at the game yesterday, and I was, you know, in the crowd. And when he came up, there was definitely a buzz among the Cleveland fans. He seems like a real fans type of player, you know, nitty gritty, you know, get yourself dirty. Is that how you guys were raised, not just in playing sports, but also just as you carry yourself about your everyday life?
Absolutely. It was just, you know, we get between the lines on the field and we're competitors. I think Jason was nicknamed Dirtbag right when he got called up into the pros and took as much pride as could be in that name. And he was always sliding, always getting dirty. And, you know, I'm creeping up on 34 now. I can't do it anymore. But, you know, even well into my upper 20s, still the idiot sliding in a 12-inch softball game here in rec leagues in Chicago. So it kind of runs in the family.
12-inch, not 16?
You know, I play both. I actually prefer 12-inch a little bit. I know that's sort of an anti-Chicago thing to say, but there's just something that's nice when you can really just square up a ball and watch it go, you know, 300-plus feet.
That's
can't
Blair.
Do that with a 16-inch ball.
That's true. That's Blair Kipnis. He's an associate attorney at Brennan Burker. And there's always next year for Cleveland, but this year it's for the Cubs. I know you're a Cub fan, too, so bittersweet, I would imagine. Thank you for joining us here on WGN.
Great. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Legal Grab Bag time on Legal Face Off WGN Plus. We've got seven topics today, but before we start, real quickly, Rich Lenkov, you were in Cleveland for Game 7 last night. The Cubs, in
hours
miraculous
ago.
Fashion, you flew back. After Cleveland, you went to Detroit, then you triangulated back to Chicago. What was that like?
It was nuts, man. I mean, you guys all watched it on TV. By now, our listeners have seen everything. It was just incredible being there, obviously. You know, I've been to lots of games this playoff, and the clincher was great last week. Who even remembers? But the one clincher for the NLCS was amazing. But yesterday topped it. I mean, Sam, you're our expert on all sports. Where does yesterday stand in the annals of Game 7 history? And then overall,
was it really
baseball
the
history?
Game
I mean, it's got to be the
Game
7. I can't think of any other Game 7s, honestly. I think there was a Rangers.
I don't know. Maybe
Cardinals, maybe?
Intense.
Who cares?
Absolutely intense.
But I mean, it's, what, greatest Game 7?
I think the greatest Game 7 was Mazeroski's walk-off in 1960 for the Pirates. Mm-hmm. That was a good one. I mean, a walk-off home run to win the World Series is pretty awesome. I mean, a little recency bias with the Cubs, but
Joe Carter was Game 6, I think, right,
for the Blue Jays? Yes, for Toronto. So in Chicago, of course, people are going to say this was the greatest one. I still think a walk-off home run to win the World Series is a little bit better, but if you ask anybody from Chicago, especially the North Side, this is 1A.
Winning the World Series is always going to put the Game 7. I mean, it's, you know, 100 years.
It was
years,
nuts. I mean, there was a ton of Cubs fans, obviously. You know, we stayed for a bit after the game.
Yeah, one of the I forget which player was interviewed, but he said it feels like it's a home game. I feel like I'm in Wrigley right now. There's so many fans left over.
I mean, it wasn't that there was more fans, because there were certainly more Indians fans in the stadium. It was probably 70-30, but
were they just
Cubs fans
louder?
Were louder, drunker. Yeah, I mean, it was fun. But
travel well.
I think Joe Maddon got off pretty good this morning. If things went another way, he'd be...
they won in spite of him.
I mean, I think so, too. I mean, the Chapman thing blew up in his face.
Yeah.
That game should have been over, but Chapman, you know, was obviously tired and overused, and then taking out Hendricks was kind of rough. But hey, in a minute from now, let alone a year from now, no one's going to remember that. They're all going to remember World Series win.
Yeah,
so it was fun.
The only thing that I can say as a Southsider is it was nice to see the Cubs get every single emotion. The fans, right? You had elation early and then heartbreak, and then they come back and they win it. So it's a great story. Cubs are World Series champions.
I think Theo Epstein, too, should have some sort of monument. I mean, to do this twice with two teams, I mean, he is an unbelievable architect. Crazy.
Yeah.
Let's move
reverse the curse two times.
Yeah. Boston and Chicago. Our guy, Bill Cosby.
Thank
back in the news.
Thank goodness for Cosby, because he's keeping us all
I love this defense,
content.
Too.
So, I mean, the interesting thing going on right now as we report this from high above the Tribune Tower here at Majestic WGN Studios is Cosby is at a hearing now in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. Two-day hearing. We're waiting for the judge to decide about whether to admit some evidence. The evidence is twofold, whether to, number one, admit his deposition testimony from about 10 years ago, which is the easier one. That will probably be admitted, because he admitted in that deposition to using drugs and alcohol with women. The bigger deal is whether this propensity evidence, that's really interesting, actually. We haven't covered that on this show before, but whether these 13 other accusers can testify in this case. The defense is arguing that that's improper. That's, more prejudicial than probative. Yeah. And in essence, you're giving the chance of these 13 women who are barred from the statute of limitations from having a trial. The prosecution is arguing that, yes, it's true that prior bad act evidence, meaning just because you robbed a bank a year ago doesn't mean you robbed a bank in this case. Generally, that's not allowed in criminal cases. They're saying that this is an exception because it's a signature. And when you have a criminal who's
modus operandi,
that's allowed in. So really interesting stuff. We'll see how the judge
rules. We had a civil case where the prior criminal act in another state was allowed in, too. So I don't know.
MO theory?
Yeah, it was under the MO theory. It didn't go to trial. We ended up settling the day of trial. So, but it can be let in. It just depends on the circumstances in the state. Is this Pennsylvania,
too?
Yeah,
Pennsylvania has that rule that it's an exception to the prior bad act.
So we talked about the hot car death trial a couple of months ago here on Legal Face-Off. The Georgia hot car death trial, the ex-wife is now saying that the dad and the son's death destroyed her life. So let's pick it up
there. Yeah, I mean, interestingly, she gave testimony for both sides. She was called by the prosecutor, who is now arrested after I think, an 18-day trial so far. The prosecution called her to talk about her relationship with her ex. She actually said that he was a great dad to her son. There was a video played of them interacting. And then she was called by the defense, and she testified that he's not a great husband, but has been also a great dad. So I don't think her testimony went very well. She did, as you said, Sam, testify that her son's death destroyed her life, which it would, you know, obviously any parent. But I think her testimony overall supported the defense. Right now, the defense is putting on their case. Again, this is the Ross Harris, who is charged with leaving his son Cooper, who was 2 at the time, or 22 months, not quite 2, in the back of his SUV while he went to work. He said that he simply forgot to drop his son off at daycare. The prosecutor is saying that this was intentional, that he was trying to get out of his life as a father and as a husband. They've introduced evidence of him sexting underage girls. So far, frankly, from looking at the trial following it, the case isn't going very well for the prosecution, but the jury will probably get it here next week.
Sumner Redstone, the media mogul, suing 2 ex-girlfriends over civil claims, including elder abuse, saying he was forced to borrow $100 million from a private company, Jay.
Yeah, we've covered the Sumner Redstone case before. Last year it was up for he was going to remove. There was a videotape where he had testified that he did not want Herzer, one of the girlfriends, to have anything to do with his probate or the estate. And now he's saying that he was forced to borrow $100 million from a private company in order to cover tax obligations on gifts that he gave to the women. He filed a lawsuit seeking about $150 million that they say he gave to his former girlfriends, Manuela Herzer and Sydney Holland. This just keeps on going with Sumner Redstone. How old is he, by the way? He's got to be 93.
He's well into his 90s. I mean, the case just doesn't stop. Obviously, you know, this all comes down to money. There's a ton of money there.
There's so much money.
You get $1 million per year almost of life. Right?
Yeah, it's unbelievable how much money they keep arguing over. But, yeah, it just continues to go. Did he have 2 girls at the same time, 2 girlfriends?
I thought so, but I don't know.
There's a picture of him posing together with the 2 of them.
Yeah.
A la Hugh Hefner.
Right. But, he's quite a...
Yeah, he's good-looking 93-year-old.
Cuts quite the figure there to Sumner Redstone.
That is a silver fox, right? Yeah. Isn't that what you're calling?
Who wouldn't want to hang out with $150 million?
So this is interesting. I use the term judge with quotation marks around it. Judge Rhonda Crawford has been barred for posing as a judge.
Yeah, I mean, who would have thought that you would have to use the word judge in quotation marks? But Rhonda Crawford, effective immediately, has had her state's, effective last week, has had her license to practice law in Illinois suspended, so that even if she wins the election on Tuesday, she is running for a judge spot. Even if she runs the election, the Supreme Court this week held that she cannot take the oath of office. This, of course, stems from her posing as a judge in Markham, in the Markham courthouse. She was clerking for a judge, and Judge Valerie Turner either allowed her, depending on who you believe, but allowed her to use her judge's robe and actually hear some cases.
She made rulings on the cases,
she made rulings on 3 separate traffic court cases. There was open discussion in court introducing her as a judge. She never spoke up. You know, the actual judge involved, Valerie Turner, is now on medical leave. She's being looked into by the Judicial Inquiry Board. But yeah, the good news is, I think that this this woman, Rhonda Crawford, even if she wins the election, which is a possibility, she won't be able to be sworn in.
Actor Tom Sizemore, in pretty much every military movie ever, he is in some trouble. A stuntman is suing Sizemore for running him over on the set of the TV show Shooter.
Sizemore becoming a regular on Legal Face-Off.
Yeah. You know, he disappeared for a while. Remember, like, in the early 2000s, he was huge. Then he kind of had to do some rehab work, make up for, I think he had a domestic altercation.
Great
too,
in but... Heat. Remember Heat?
Yeah,
De Niro, with Pacino. Yeah. He plays one of the bad guys.
Yeah. He was also, what was that mean? Black Hawk Down. He was really good in that.
Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. You're right, Sam. Every military movie made in the last 20 years.
There's a scene in Heat in the diner where, remember, they pull the one guy who snitches on them. They pull him into the booth. And there's, like, you know, De Niro and Sizemore. De Niro bashes this guy's head into the counter and pulls it back up. And there's another guest in the diner who looks. And Sizemore just does this. He just looks sideways. looks at the guy, and the guy goes back to his business. It's just Sizemore a great piece of acting by Sizemore.
He has like, that look, too.
Don't F with us.
That's
he doesn't seem like he's...
Is that in Heat?
In Heat. It's a great scene.
He was also in Natural Born Killers.
Yeah,
he was in Pearl Harbor.
True Romance, one of my favorite movies of all time. He was in that.
Point Break.
You know, True Romance.
No. Yeah, he was in Point Break, the original one?
Yeah.
Really?
No.
Yeah,
that's,
he was in Point Break.
That's Gary Busey.
He was in Point Break.
No way.
How much do you want to bet?
I will fight you on that one.
Was
I
he know, just a bat, like
I
an extra?
I know Point Break really well.
Because Point Break was like mid-90s, right?
No, there's no Tom Sizemore in Point Break.
I got five on it.
No way. I got 10.
I got five singles.
I got a World Series ticket with your name on it, Sam.
Oh, yeah.
Well, anyway, he apparently was drunk on the set, and that's the allegation, and he ran over or hit a stuntman. And according to the lawsuit that was filed, they didn't cite what injuries the stuntman sustained, but they're alleging that he knowingly operated a vehicle while intoxicated and hit the stuntman. So,
by the way, I love how Sam is betting me while looking directly at the guy's IMDb page.
Like, no, I don't have it up, but I should pull it up. Actually, I don't have it up in front of me. I will do that as we.
You're just basing that on your memory of the movie Point Break.
He was in Point Break, yes.
And then you're basing that on your knowledge of the movie Point Break.
I want to establish that for the record, hardcore right now.
On the FCC airways.
Googling there Tom you go.
All right, so you Google it.
I'm hitting IMDb.
How are you betting with the information directly in front of you?
Hey, Pete Rose can do it. I can do it.
All right, let's go.
Let's move to Dr. Dre, who reportedly, according to the Hollywood Reporter, had tried to have Suge Knight killed.
Yeah, according to sources, they say that Dr. Dre tried to have Suge Knight killed, and Suge Knight wants 30% of the $1 billion deal that Dr. Dre earned when he sold Beats to Apple. He claimed that, well, Dr. Dre is saying that he hasn't had anything to do with Suge
Knight. Get the names of the rappers right.
You know, I know you're more in touch with your urban roots, but I have a little hard time here getting my 1990s rapper straight. But it says that Dr. Dre is saying that he hasn't had any interaction with Suge Knight since leaving Death Row Records in 1996. However, the sources go on to quote that Suge Knight claims Dr. Dre was responsible for an incident at a Compton spot locals refer to as Murder Burger.
Murder Burger. Ooh. Put Murder Burger on the list of three restaurants I will never eat at.
I don't even know where that's at or what that is, but yeah, never, ever, ever. That does not sound appetizing.
Yeah, I'll take a double cheeseburger and death, please, to go.
Yeah. But I thought Suge Knight was already in prison, wasn't he?
I think he's out. I mean, he was out for a while.
Because he ran over that guy. That's what the lawsuit
allegedly held someone by their ankles over a balcony over a contract dispute. Was it
Eazy-E?
Vanilla Ice, I think.
Was it Eazy-E?
Well, he beat the crap out of Eazy-E, too, to try and break him out of that record deal.
Yeah.
He wanted to free Dr. Dre. I was a West Coast hip-hop guy, so I should...
Well, I mean, based on his reputation,
days, man.
Based on Suge Knight's reputation, he probably is owed all this money from Dr. Dre.
He's a thug.
Yeah.
Easy.
Oh, yeah, he's
He'll
probably
pay
listening.
You a visit.
Yeah. Hang me
Don't
over.
Don't go to Murder Burger.
Yeah, balcony. We round up the legal grab bag with Slash, famous guitarist, going through a divorce right now.
Yeah, Slash, the question is whether he was married, or the legal question is whether you can... secure alimony and child support from someone you were never really married to. It turns out that while Perla, I don't have her last name, but his...
Bigamy, isn't it?
Well, it could be. They married in 2001, but she was still married to another guy. So either he doesn't owe her anything because they're never married, or she has the right to share in her earnings. I mean, they were married for 13 years, but her marriage to this other guy, Carlos Marti, lasted only a month. She got divorced. It turns out she wasn't officially divorced because the papers weren't filed. And now, fast forward to now, she is asking for half of Slash's earnings, which obviously, if you're a Guns N' Roses fan like me, you'll know that that's in the tens of millions of dollars. She is alleging that she's entitled to half his earnings. The question is whether there's actually a law about putative spouses, which means that if two people have a reasonable belief that they're married, but there's some paperwork irregularity, then a judge can still treat them as married. So that'll be the question in this case.
And this is California law, too, which God knows what that is.
Exactly. I mean, pretty liberal when it comes to that kind of thing. Anyone attend the Guns N' Roses show? I attended it with a member of Whiteside and... Goldberg.
He got you some pretty
couple months ago.
Pretty great seats too,
I don't
right?
know about that. We were pretty far guys, from Slash.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if it was Slash or this ex-wife,
or
by the way.
13-year-old band.
I was
that
so
was
far.
Up there
thanks to the Goldberg and Whiteside seats. Yeah.
Our research team, by the way, has conducted the following investigation. Tom Sizemore played Agent Dietz in Point Break.
Semi is $10 richer.
There's no, he says there's no way.
I'm looking it up right now. On as we look at that, let's talk about, Sam, your favorite Guns N' Roses song.
Oh, wow. I like the Sweet Emotion cover, but original Guns N' Roses song, probably, oh, wow.
On the spot.
Yeah, on the spot.
Paradise City. You like some Sweet Child O' Mine. You like some Welcome
ones,
to the Jungle. November Rain.
November Rain's a good one.
That's
I'd
a pretty
like
good jam,
Rain.
Right?
No, I'll take the easy out with all those the Paradise City and yeah. all that stuff. It's great songs.
I love me. I mean, it's a little bit of a cop out because it's a cover, but Live and Let Die is amazing. Much better than the original Wings one. And
we should get a phone call in from Ames.
We'll have the answer on Agent Deeds for our next show.
I think we already got
that'll
it.
Be our, that'll be our cliffhanger.
I think we already got it with
no
the,
way, you're
with,
wrong.
With the Vic rolling you're on the wrong. $10.
Oh, I forgot about Patience, too. Patience by Guns N' Roses.
I'll call us off
just
with a little Patience
little
whistle.
Patience. Thanks to our guest, Alderman Leslie
one
Harrison.
One of the most famous whistles in rock history in Patience.
Thanks. Rich is doing a shimmy here
yeah,
in the studio.
I'm doing
it's
my axle.
Not so attractive.
Jessica Jackson Sloan, Marnie Willenson, Joshua Karsh, Blair Kipnis. You owe me five because we had five on it.
Five Canadian dollars, right?
five pesos.
Yeah.
We'll see you in 2 weeks on Legal Face Up.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg Limited for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.